With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, music critic David Stubbs on his book Future Days, Krautrock and the Building of Modern Germany. David Stubbs joined the music magazine Melodymaker in 1986, where he worked for 12 years. His most famous creation, Mr. Agreeable, periodically reawakens over at The Quietus. He has also written for The Guardian, The Enemy, The Wire, When Saturday Comes and Uncut, and was a presenter on the Resonance FM football show Café Calcio. David is the author of numerous books, including Fear of Music, Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen, which we discussed on a previous Little Atoms. And his latest book is Future Days, Krautrock and the Building of Modern Germany, which we're going to be talking about today. So, David, welcome back, first of all.
Yes, glad to be back.
Let's first of all get this term Krautrock out of the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's somewhat problematic, right?
It was problematic, and yes, and I felt it's, you know, define your terms, very first thing I had to do, because on the one hand, I think the actual bands themselves, you know, the remaining surviving members, they bridled somewhat at the mention of this word, because obviously they come from a time when they considered it deeply insulting. And in fact, you know, when he was ringing up or whatever, or, you know, occasionally trying to get contact, you know, making direct contact occasionally with one or two of these people, they had to sort of say, I've written a book about experimental German music of the late 1960s and early 1970s. You know, he couldn't use the dreaded K word. But you can't, it's unavoidable. It was coined, actually, subsequently, after I wrote the book, Simon Draper, who went on to work for Virgin Records, he was kind of working in marketing at the time. He claimed that, in fact, he and his people, as it were at the time, they coined the term purely so that, like, this music that was emerging, all these groups like Can and Fast, you'd be able to kind of go directly to a rack and record shop and find them. It was a similar thing with world music, which, again, is a sort of much derided and scorned term. But I met Roger Armstrong, who's had Ace Records, and he was involved in the coining of it, and he said, look, it's just a rack in a record shop. Before the term world music was coined, these records, you know, want to find this great singer from Algeria, you wouldn't know where to start.
So it does seem like that, I mean, in that painful way that you see on the internet now, where middle-class white men are the last minority you can have a go at sort of thing, it does seem like Krautrock is almost that. You wouldn't get away with that for any other nationality.
You absolutely wouldn't. I mean, as I said, there is something inherently appalling about it in the context of the times. Just imagine, like, if Jimi Hendrix, somebody said, hey, this is great, let's call it Spade Rock. You know, or if it were in the French, let's call it frog rock instead of prog rock or whatever. I mean, it's obviously, it was well-meaning. You know, it wasn't seen as derogatory, though it may have been interpreted as being derogatory. But, it, you know, in terms of the sort of, that there was still that abiding cultural hostility, you know, between the UK and Germany. I think it was definitely well-meant. But, of course, you know, at the time it was also difficult because German bands had to endure a lot of condescension from the UK press and headlines like "We have means of making you listen." And you can imagine sub-editors, as soon as they kind of were faced with the prospect of a German band in a music paper, you know, there's combs going right under their noses and like goose-stepping up and down, you know, the corridors of the office. But it was well-meant, oddly enough. But another thing is, of course, the word has now become very commonplace. Mm-hmm. And there's now a very different attitude about 40 years on towards things German, which is post-David Bowie, I think, actually. There was something inherently comical about Germans making rock music pre-David Bowie, sort of having his Berlin phase and what have you. Post-David Bowie, anything sort of Germanic had a certain cool about it, you know, so you get, especially in that post-punk era, and you get bands like names like Bauhaus emerging, and, you know, the new Teutonic cool or whatever. And these days, krautrock, I think, has been sort of semantically cleansed. It doesn't have those kind of old conversations. No one talks about the kraut anymore, no one talks about the Bosch or Jerry anymore. I mean, that's belongs to a previous generation. So it's a very, very cool and much bandied word or whatever that is so that you really have to, you can't avoid using it. And so what I did when you knew some krautrock, I tried to sort of, as it were, invent my own, come up with my own definition of krautrock, which is a bunch of very diverse bands, but with very common properties, which is to do with kind of innovation, use of electronics, and not so much emphasis on sort of the vocals and the upfront vocalists, reconfiguring the whole way in which a rock band is arranged. You know, things are also essentially rejecting the Anglo-American blues-based model of making music. They all have that in common. They all, in a very different way.
So. Well, let's talk about what gets left out then, because I want to talk about the sort of the historical and the political context of when this music was being made. But let's first of all talk about the musical context. So, in Germany, in particular, what else was going on that this was different from?
Well, essentially, there were two things going on. I mean, and this is West Germany as opposed to East Germany. There was such a thing as Ostrock, in was sort of separate sort of rock history in East Germany, but with entirely different sort of cultural sort of imperatives or whatever. So in West Germany, you know, there was, in literally metaphorically, you know, there was occupation. So you had the UK and US based troops there or whatever, and they go out to dances and things like that. So in certain areas, they put on predominance of US troops, and they would probably want to hear Motowny type things, soul or country or whatever. And then other areas where it was UK-based troops, and they would essentially want to listen to Beatles-type stuff, you know. And so there was a band called the Rattles, you know, who were a sort of, obviously, a bit like the Ruttles, really, you know, who were a kind of clearly Beatles-inspired combo. So that was one thing that was going on. And the other thing that was going on, of course, was Schlager, which was this kind of very sort of Eurovision-type formica folk pop, which I think was common to a lot of other countries, really, you know, this. And, you know, as I say, tends to emerge really in Eurovision Song Contests, you know, sort of Tupperware, sort of romantic, sort of bucolic romanticism about, you know, the country of origin that's sort of, you know, heavily diluted folk with a kind of sort of banal pop sheen. The only thing is, in West Germany, it had a certain connotation. It was a bit like what they called Heimatfilm. You know, there was a sort of industry of like making films that were kind of nostalgic about sort of 20 or 30 years ago, for a kind of sort of rural Germany, in which somehow or other the unfortunate events of 1933 to 1945 was mysteriously erased. And this is a kind of music that's kind of very nostalgic and wistful and like, you know, an idyllic, but a certain kind of rural-based German life, which recent traumatic events are completely airbrushed. So there's two things going on. So on the one hand, you've got this sense of, like, you know, the new music being kind of imported, like a kind of cultural Marshall Plan or whatever. And then on the other hand, you've got the music that represents this culture of amnesia. And I think that for us, for quite a lot of musicians, or in various ways, but certainly all of the musicians that, you know, I write about in the book, they felt it was deeply humiliating, you know, this idea. And I think they felt that it was their responsibility as young Germans to kind of reconnect with the great sort of traditions of invention, and that, you know, was kind of part of almost like their sort of German sort of, you know, tradition and heritage. So consequently, the first thing they had to do was reject the Anglo-American sort of blues-based thing, and that consequently meant approaching making rock music in a very innovative way. And obviously it meant doing something that was antithetical in spirit musically to the, you know, to the whole Schlager thing. So it was going to be very sort of hippie-based. It was going to kind of have very, very sort of different trapping from that particular music.
So let's talk about you've already mentioned it a bit, but the political context, the time. So the time period, it's sort of post-war, but we're in the... You cover sort of, what, the mid-60s to 77, roughly, in this book, and this is when this... I don't really know how to describe it. Movement, it's not really a movement, genre, it's not really a genre, but these sort of groups, and again, we'll get on in a moment to why you've grouped these groups together, but this period that you cover, roughly mid-60s to the mid-70s, it's obviously before the Berlin Wall comes down, East and West Germany, but as you've also mentioned, there's still the sort of tail end of the occupation, really, of certain American soldiers are still there.
Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose, obviously, in about 68, I mean, in common with other countries, in common with, you know, in the US and certainly France, whatever, there was a sort of great sense of revolution, upheaval, and one of the kind of catalytic events was the shooting of a protester. I think the Shah made an official visit, and the protester was shot dead, and that was a kind of catalyst for a lot of kind of student activity and students. And that really sort of helped give an emerging counterculture, its kind of political edge, you know, and there was a lot of sort of literature, sort of manifestos. Eventually, all kinds of things happened, and, you know, obviously it was reflected in literature, in cinema or whatever. So, for instance, someone like Frank Zappa was kind of a touchstone. Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And he produced an album in 1967 called Absolutely Free, and there's a song with Plastic People, and one of the verses is like, "Watch the Nazis run your town." Now, of course, he's talking about, it's a bit like California rights, you know, he's using the term Nazis in a sort of metaphorical way, you know. But these, in West Germany, actual Nazis were running actual towns, the out-Nazis. So the sort of the general sort of wave, revolutionary wave, you know, that was occurring, you know, between sort of students of that generation, had a particular resonance if you were young and West German. You know, you really were on, you know, still under the thumb of the Nazis. There were specific sort of issues that you were addressing as somebody just coming of age in the late 60s. All of a sudden, you're inevitably finding out a little bit about what happened in the Second World War. You're probably sort of divining, leaning a little bit about things like the Holocaust, and then you're stunned, and perhaps you're going back home and saying, "Mum, Dad, Grandma, Granddad, you never mentioned anything about this." I mean, you can just imagine, you know, that sense of just horror and revulsion, like what, you know, this, what you were being, what you were born into.
Well, we often talk of that sort of period in this country as people sort of rebelling against their parents' generation, and obviously in Germany, that's got that whole other sort of layer to it as well.
I mean, it was paradoxical because it was strange. It was people born into a sort of prosperity or whatever. Mm. It wasn't the sort of alienation, disaffection that comes from poverty or whatever. It wasn't the sort of anti-Thatcher thing or the kind of punk thing. It was a reflection of what was seen as the kind of the moribund. Of like the UK, you know, these were people that were kind of, you know, well fed. They've been a kind of material economic miracle in West Germany, and there was great sort of prosperity. There hadn't been a sort of a moral miracle, whatever, you know. Just, I mean, in the early 50s, there was a survey taken in which only 5% of West Germans, only 5% of West Germans felt they had any reason to be guilty towards the Jews, and this at a time when they pretty much restored, you know, the economic prosperity to the country.
But also, that's an economic prosperity that's done by, you know, somebody else, the Marshall Plan,
American
money.
That's right. So yeah. I mean, I think it was a twin thing, wasn't it? I think so. It was the Marshall Plan, but it was also, I think, almost kind of, you know, this sort of sublimation of like energies or whatever into sort of really sort of dedicating yourself to the sort of, you know, the material rebuilding, possibly as a kind of way of not having to face up to other realities. You know, just put your head down, dig, work hard, get things back right there. And I think there was a hell of a lot of investment, sort of psychologically speaking. I think there was a hell of a lot of investment in just getting the country back to sort of material prosperity, where very little sort of effort put into kind of moral reflection.
You've touched on it a bit, but let's say again how you define krautrock in this book. What bands are in? What sort of?
Yeah, I mean,
the common
for instance, the common characteristics. For instance, there were other bands that were kind of part of the counterculture that I've talked about, who were much more explicit about it. There was kind of a protest folk. There were kind of bands that were much almost like kind of more punkish and were very kind of explicit, you know, about their kind of complaints and grievances. And one of the things about krautrock is it doesn't really, it's much more kind of, you know, it clearly is defined by the trauma of like the Second World War or whatever, because they talk about that. I mean, someone like Ralph Hultrout of Kraftwerk said, "We had no fathers." You know, they really felt they had to kind of reconnect in their particular case with, say, things like the Bauhaus movement. Groups like Can, you know, felt that they had to sort of, you know, they had to sort of forget, you know, what happened previously. They had to build something from scratch. So I think that's one of the first things. All of these bands, I think, feel this need to begin again. You have to sort of reassemble music, almost as if music has never been made before. You know, you have to make a kind of a new start, you know, on this sort of, you know, there's a sense of cultural rubble, whatever, you know, and ruins, whatever. And then you have to rebuild using that as a basis, which from a musical point of view is tremendously exciting. You know, means all kinds of sort of new shapes, new forms, new impetus, the embrace of like things like electronics, which, you know, when rock, Anglo-American rock does really tend to be really rather conservative and was really kind of, you know, synths and stuff like synths, synthesizers were very expensive, but there were all kinds of electronic devices and that were available, but there was a sense they were kind of fake and inauthentic. But, you know, with these West German groups, you know, positively embraced that kind of thing because they saw the possibilities of, they saw innovative properties that these things had, you know, the kind of the shapes and the form, you know, the forms, the colour, you know, the way you could sort of colourise music all of a sudden, the directions in which you could sort of, you know, take the sound. So that was a really important thing. There were various other things. There was a sort of an aversion to the lead singer, and quite often both Can and Kraftwerk say this. They tend to operate as collectives. They said, you know, that the idea of like the hierarchy that you normally have with a group, with the front man and then perhaps the guitarist, and then, you know, in the subordinate role, you know, the bass and the drummer holding down the back seat. And they didn't like the idea of the sort of self-glorification, you know, that comes with a lot of rock music and that vast ego, because, as they explicitly said, you know, we had that with a certain Mr. Adolf Hitler, you know, the Nuremberg rallies, and which have often been compared, you know, with the sort of euphoria he whipped up as being not dissimilar. I mean, people like Liebach are quite good on this, you know, the uncomfortable similarity between a certain strain of rock music and the Nuremberg rallies, you know, the kind of that sort of slightly inebriated euphoria in which people can be whipped up, you know, by a kind of very charismatic single person standing up there on the stage. So there was very much of an aversion to that. So consequently, this is why things, you know, so that kind of collectivism in the way they kind of make the music affects the sort of nature of the music. It tends to be kind of have more of a sort of fluidity about it. You know, the kind of various musical elements are kind of free-floating.
Do you think also that that, really subsequently, we'll perhaps talk later about why most of these bands didn't really sort of break out. It's not until much later that they had their sort of legacy. Is that something to do with that, do you think? I mean, perhaps if each of these bands had some sort of iconic lead singer, they would have been
popular. I mean, I think, yes, absolutely. You know, the fact that they didn't play the game. They didn't play the game that should be played. And I mean, the thing about what they didn't really succeed in doing was, like, inventing a new set of rules that would then make them immensely popular. Yeah. I mean, that just didn't happen. And you know, mostly one thing a lot, again, another thing, whether it was like Alan Dool, you know, operating out of a commune system, whether it was Can operating out of Slushnovenich or Faust at this kind of Wummer complex out in the countryside, all of these bands tended to kind of work in a sort of like in sort of hermetic isolation, Kraftwerk in the Kling Klang studios. That meant that they weren't going to be meddled with by the kind of, you know, as it were, the sort of the commercial record industry or whatever, you know, with sound engineers imposed on them or whatever. They could sort of go there, they could sort of start from scratch, make their own rules. You know, they could go into the studio, you know, they didn't even have to have pre-recorded, because it wasn't really a song-based thing very much. So they just go in and start playing and then see what happened. Very, very experimental indeed from that point of view. But what's ironic is that, and it's an irony that persists to this day, is that there were prophets without honour save in their own country, that West Germans themselves didn't really embrace these groups at all and still don't really. So it's very hard, quite often, you know, to, in terms of like when they were kind of trying to get gigs and things like that. Obviously, some people would turn up, but quite often in humiliatingly small numbers. Michael Rother out of Neue talks about when he's with the group Harmonia driving about, you know, sort of 300 kilometres a gig, at which only two people turned up, you know, in the mid-70s. And these kind of things happened, and they didn't really, Germans weren't really, and still aren't impressed by this legacy. So that was a problem then, and it remains a problem now. But it was only when, actually, France was the first country that started taking the music seriously. First France, then the UK, fairly quickly afterwards, and then eventually, gradually, the rest of the world years later.
I'm Olivia Lang, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
You mentioned that sort of post-68 energy that a lot of these bands were sort of fomented in, and that gradually in Germany, I guess as everywhere else, but specifically in Germany, sort of dissipates into the early 70s, and you get things
does,
like,
yeah,
you know, the RAF, the Red Army Faction, and eventually the Baader-Meinhof group.
Yeah.
To what extent were this musical movement involved in that sort of political scene?
Yeah, there's very little overlap at all, really. I mean, you'll occasionally hear stories of, like, obviously the kind of commune-type existence that we've had in places like Allendale or whatever, in Munich or whatever. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, there might have been some sort of intersection on the kind of periphery. But there's almost, I think people almost, like, want there to be some sort of correlation between Baader-Meinhof and, you know, the sexy terrorism of the Baader-Meinhof group and Krautrock, and there's very little at all. One thing they do have in common is that, of course, most of those groups, even Kraftwerk early on, they had long hair. They looked like hippies. They looked like they could be and you know, they looked like they could be members of the Mile High Group, and consequently suffered in terms of, like, you know, stop and search and arrest. You know, they really suffered. I mean, John Vinesill, who I interviewed from Allendale, he said that he couldn't believe it when he came to England looking the way that he did, and that he was just treated so civilly. He said that it's just not the case in West Germany. And I think the reason for that was obviously the suspicion of, like, if you look like that, well, there's chances are you're a terrorist of some sort. So they suffered a lot of, you know, prejudice as a result of that. But the actual Baader-Meinhof group themselves, I mean, there's no evidence that there was no real kind of crossover at all. And as I point out in the book, that when Andreas Baader died and they went into his cell, they found his record player. It was an Eric Clapton record. Even Eric Clapton fan. Which, you know, is very dismaying in some ways. So, yeah, the answer, there's been elements of wishful thinking sometimes about the overlap between Krautrock and Baader-Meinhof, but they were opposite extremisms.
I want to talk later about the subsequent influence on other bands of the Krautrock movement, but let's talk about what influenced them. And you've talked about this idea that they explicitly rejected British and American sort of rock music. But, so what were their roots?
Well, paradoxically, see, although that was the case, nonetheless, groups like, for instance, Pink Floyd were very influential, and so were Velvet Underground, who Erwin Schmidt out of Cannes was greatly impressed with when he went to America. But I think in the way that what impressed Erwin Schmidt out of Velvet Underground is he felt that they were, you know, they were going back to sort of first principles, back to absolute sort of basics, whatever, and a sort of like an application of minimalist principles to rock music. So they themselves were kind of involved in sort of rejecting a certain kind of modern music. And Pink Floyd, obviously, on the album Amagama, for instance, the live album there, has a very sort of proto-Kosmische feel, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people like Asherah Temple, they sort of took up where Pink Floyd left off there. So, yeah, there is a paradox there that, in fact, certain British groups, you know, in the psychedelic phase, and one or two American groups, definitely were influential. Obviously, Stockhausen is somebody that kind of hangs over all of this, and a whole Schukein was a pupil, you know, from Cannes. He was a pupil of Stockhausen. And Stockhausen, I suppose, who was born in 1926, he was young enough, he would have been a member of the Hitler Youth, which was obligatory, you know, there was no getting around that. He lost both his parents in the Second World War, and he emerged as a teenager. And I think that his instinct then was to kind of, his own instinct, I think, was to kind of make a music. He was working, I mean, electronic music was now a kind of possibility, and there were all kinds of sort of ways of like making music that could be kind of just, you know, generated by that means. And I think there was an appeal there about a music that was utterly untainted, you know, by this kind of fallen world, that something that could be absolutely new in origin, that was almost like, that was out there, you know, in space or whatever. And so, you know, so for him, he preferred that approach to kind of facing up to what going to. It was too traumatic, I think, to kind of have some sort of explicit biographical, autobiographical reflection, you know, on what he'd kind of been through. I think that, you know, there's almost a sense in which the music is a solace of Stockhausen, as well as being extremely challenging. There's a kind of a solace, you know, that is. And that's actually true for Krautrock as well, because, let's say, they don't. There are fleeting occasions. There's references to the, you know, there's a Kraftwerk track, one of the early albums, you know, of which you get the sense of, like, bombers kind of hoving overhead and, you know, the sound of aerial warfare or what have you. But by and large, the music is, it's healing music, it's fertile, it's creative, it's the sort of, it's the green shoots, you know, over the kind of, you know, the stony rubble. So I think that Stockhausen was definitely, yeah, he was definitely a forefather of the whole thing, although Stockhausen himself wasn't very impressed by the music.
But even so, there's something interestingly, some intellectual foundations there. I can't imagine many British 60s and 70s rock bands would be, you know, would be claiming to be influenced by sort of avant-garde composers.
No, absolutely. But I think there's a kind of, I mean, I suppose, you know, in German culture, I mean, lots of these bands would have played, you know, especially on Dusseldorf, you know, they'd have played in galleries. That was a perfectly natural thing to do. And I think, and that's a big contrast there with the English rock scene, where although a lot of them went to art school, that was kind of for the DOS, really, or whatever. And there's a lot of resistance to anything kind of arty, and the idea that it was arty-farty, pretentious, effete. Even John Lennon, despite his later things with Yoko Ono, that was his attitude. And it's reflected in the music, and it's clearly not an interest in treating rock. I mean, this is why Brian Eno is so important when he eventually emerges. He's almost like an honorary Krautrock, but he's completely unabashed about the idea of, like, creating music with titles as if it's kind of watercolours or whatever, you know, and sort of taking interest in the form of music as, you know, more so even than the content, you know, and therefore help inaugurate things like ambient music. But, you know, he was very much in sync with what people like Ashra Temple were doing, and what Can were doing, and, you know, into a extent what people like Noy were doing. So Brian Eno was very much in sync with those people, and it became a very important sort of bridge build, you know, between people like, you know, sort of Noy and Kraftwerk and David Bowie.
So why, David, do you like this stuff? Tell us about when you first discovered it.
Well, actually, this was as a kid. I was a football fan. I'm sure, like, well, if you ever are a football fan, you're a football fan probably before you're a serious music fan. I remember watching games in the early 1970s that were broadcasts from Europe, you know, and it's quite often involving Germany, West Germany, teams like Bayern Munich. And back then, there was a real sense of otherness about games that were broadcast from abroad. You know, you could tell there was, on two counts. First of all, the commentary sounded like it was having to be phoned in. You know, there was a bit of a blur around the images because, you know, they were coming via satellite or whatever. But also, whereas football crowds in this country tend to be sort of slightly boorish and chant, when European games, they tend to be this wall of sound, you know, this kind of chorus of air horns that was just relentless throughout. And I just found that mesmerising. And I just loved these kind of incessant drones, and I think I became slightly kind of in love with all of that and all the kind of exotic associations of otherness with all of that, you know, at a young age, that I think that was my first inkling of that sort of Teutonic otherness that I kind of found in sort of, you know, in the krautrock sound. So yeah, and I studied German a little bit at school, and I think I became a sort of a Germanophile, actually. You know, post-war West Germany actually seemed to me, in the late 70s, actually to be, for all of the kind of social problems that were there, it seemed to be a very kind of cool and quite kind of advanced culture in lots of ways. So I definitely became kind of a Germanophile. I just had a sense that they did things better in West Germany.
What happened in Germany after this period then? Post-77, happens to German music?
Well, it's odd, really, because all kind of things are kind of out of sync. For instance, in popular culture, by the time, I mean, krautrock, most of those groups have kind of petered out, they've gone straight, they've split up by about 1976, 77, with the exception of Kraftwerk, who then go on to build their enormous...
They become massive after that.
Yeah,
really,
that's right, yeah. But they do belong, you know, in this tradition and, you know, in this category, as it were. But, yeah, I mean, politically, I think there is... It's ironic. I mean, there's a sort of... On a cultural level, I mean, you've got things like that film Hitler, a film from Germany in 1977. You've got, I mean, the Bader Meinhof group really comes to a sort of crest in terms of their activities. And you've also got, actually, the one thing that was a real awakening was actually that American series, Holocaust, which is a very Americanized sort of tale. You know, they've got the family, the Weiss family. They don't even go to the Weiss family, but they deliberately Americanized it to give it universal appeal. And that actually was then sold back to Germany. And that had a huge impact, that series. That may have done more to kind of popularize or awaken people to sort of some of the realities of the Holocaust than any other thing, ironically. In terms of music, well, punk was just happening then, and obviously, much as it did in the UK, well, it very much did in the UK, it kind of, like, cleaved rock history in half, you know, and there was a real sort of BCAD type feel about punk. And so what happened in West German music, you had what's called the Neue Deutsche Welle, the New Wave, and you have groups like Einstürzen und Neubauten and DAF and Der Plan. And in lots of ways, they're very different from the krautrock groups. They're much more song-based. They sing in German in a very kind of harsh, guttural, in-your-face, aggressive terms. They're very explicit politically. And yet at the same time, what they've got in common with Can, with Faust, all of those groups, is that... they're innovative. They're interested in deconstruction, reconstruction of the song, you know, and finding new shapes and new ways of making music.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to David Stubbs, and we're talking about his book Future Days, Krautrock and the Building of Modern Germany. And so, David, let's, in this half, look at some of the bands. Amon Dul, first of all. And they absolutely symbolise the not only the growth out of the commune systemness of Krautrock, but they have this really weird genealogy and loads of confusing releases.
Well, this is it, because the thing is, there's Amon Dul and there's Amon Dul 2. And Amon Dul 2 were basically the musicians. So Amon Dul originally, it was just like a free-for-all. If you could just pick up an instrument and just make a noise, a very, very sort of, you know, so music isn't really, you know, his music is just an expression of just absolute inclusive liberalism. And I think Amon Dul too said, no, we can be a little bit more serious about this. So they broke away and they kind of made proper records, you know, where they, you know, they felt it was actually important to be able to play. You couldn't just drone wail away or whatever. So a schism developed there. In fact, Amon Dul, the original collective, they made about three or four albums, but they're all essentially cut from the same set of recordings. You know, they didn't really kind of go on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You know, there was just the same sort of blaring, wailing, caterwauling kind of noise or whatever. All, you know, they just grabbed it all together and made out as if they got, you know, this body of work, and it wasn't really at all. And Amon Dul too, they are very much the wing that were inspired by, I think, you know, sort of like a predominantly sort of UK type psychedelia. And I mean, what's interesting about them, especially on their early albums, is there's almost kind of, you know, in terms of like the use of improv, there's a sort of sense of sort of collage and sort of pushing together out in the way that like people like the Mothers of Invention were doing around the same sort of time. But the only thing about Amon Dul is they kind of trail off. I think ultimately they probably weren't as interested in some of the other bands in creating sort of new forms that would be their kind of signature or whatever. I think it was really their ambition to become some sort of mainstream neo-psychedelic underground type band or whatever.
Yeah, they do sound and, most you know, like more, a rock band.
That's right. And eventually, you know, and the further you go on, they just become a conventional rock band, which sometimes happens with experimental music. And it happens quite, you know, it's the story of all these people. What sound, you know, they sound really interesting early on, but they themselves think, no, we are experimental in the sense we're trying different things out. We don't think a lot of this stuff works. We actually want to be pretty much, you know, we'll consider ourselves complete when we're what people like me would consider conventional. I mean, there's an element to that with Tangerine Dream, for instance, as well. But they are interesting around the world because I think in the timeline, you know, they are the first, and there is, you know, there's the sense that like they're in the evolutionary sort of timeline of the genre. I think the fact that they kind of almost like jump out of the sort of pool of that whole kind of commune thing that's going on into, you know, actually making sort of serious recordings. But as is sometimes the case, you know, the earlier the better, definitely.
So as we go through these bands, yeah, recommend us some stuff that listeners should try if they want to. I've been listening to Yeti on
repeat. I mean, there you go. Well, this is it. Yeah. I think start with Yeti and thereabouts, and I think yeah, you can't go wrong. Yeah.
Okay, so Cannes. Let's move on to Cannes. You mentioned this idea earlier of failure of the denazification of West Germany. It can come out of Cologne, which is a place which did have a mayor, a politician, who was, right up until the 1980s, was unapologetically
an artist. Well, yeah, absolutely. Although I think Cologne, people in Cologne like to think that they sort of put up slightly stiffer resistance than some other areas of Germany. But obviously, yes, they suffered greatly. Cologne was razed to the ground, except that, obviously the church is maintained. I mean, the church is almost like a symbol of the distinctive character for me of Cologne, actually, with this kind of very, very kind of rich and vivacious and slightly anarchic, whatever, and with a kind of, a sort of a lust for life. And if you think of, like, Dusseldorf, it's perhaps sort of tidier and more tapered in lots of ways. There seems to be a real distinctive... This is one of the great things about, much as in the whole post-punk scene where, say, Liverpool and Manchester had distinctive characters that were reflected in the bands. Liverpool had bands with extravagant titles like Teardrop Explodes, Echo and the Bunnymen, Hamby and the Dance, whatever. Then you go over to Manchester, it's more bleak and laconic, The Fall, The Passage magazine. You get a similar thing, I think, with Dusseldorf and Cologne, but obviously Cannes are the great exponents of Cologne music at the time. But, having said that, they're even today, Jackie Liebertzeit, the drummer of Cannes, he lives in Cologne. There should be a statue of Jackie Liebertzeit, but he says, I go to Bolivia, I'll land, I get mobbed by fans there, I come back to Cologne, I'm completely ignored. And it was, I went around them, all day in Cologne, even in the arts complex where he worked, no one particularly seemed to know who he was or pay him any great mind. But Cannes are probably, some people might say, they are, Kraftwerk perhaps sort of had the most far-reaching achievement. Cannes are perhaps the greatest of the bands that I talk about.
I was unfamiliar with a lot of this music. I'd heard the names, but were actually unfamiliar with the sounds. And I said Amon Dul sounded to me like an early 70s rock band.
Yeah.
Whereas Cannes sounded to me like what I expected Krautrock to sound like. And they've got that signature. You just talked about Jackie Liebertzeit, the drummer, and his drumming technique is quite... Tell us about that.
He's a really important figure because he comes out of the kind of... actually the jazz world, whatever. But somebody who, probably in the very early 1960s, when it was a very difficult thing to do, who had kind of, he managed to get hold of albums of like Indian music, whatever. And so he'd seen sort of alternative, oriental, as it were, ways of music making. Jazz in the 60s became very, very, really kind of quite extreme, the days of so-called free jazz. But he didn't consider it free at all. He considered it a bit like 20th century classical music that Erwin Schmidt was sort of steeped in, which he called Stalinist. He considered it riven with dogma, actually. It purports to be free and chaotic, but it's actually nothing of the sort. And Jackie Liebertzeit, I think, sort of seized on this sort of paradox that in order to be truly free, you have to be almost mechanically, you have to be incredibly repetitious and tight, and from there, freedom flows. Mm-hmm. And so, that's always the thing that's running through Cannes, is these kind of very cyclical, repetitive style, drumming styles that he does, that are really nothing else that you'll find in rock music. And what that does, that enables a kind of what Flow Motion is one of the titles of one of their tracks. So all the other elements are then able to kind of free float. The drums are kind of actually unmoored from their traditional role. They're not sort of pegged to the kind of conventional sort of patterns of like blues-based rock. And the music kind of levitates. And it's also a strange thing, but everybody else in the group has the same attitude. Erwin Schmidt is a classically trained keyboardist. He could sort of, if he wanted to, he could have out-progged like Rick Wakeman or any of the Keith Emerson or any of those people, in terms of his virtuosity. Mm-hmm. But he saw no point in being a virtuoso. He was more interested in the idea of ideas and aptitude, which was actually a very punk idea. He happened to have the training, but he would prefer to kind of just stick a finger in the middle of the keyboard and just make a kind of drone if that was what was required, or make kind of helicopter-type noises or whatever, or suddenly shift the music in another direction by karate chop, to the keyboard. And Holger Schukai played bass, but again, he played it in a very similar spirit to Jackie Liebertzeit on the drums, quite often simply sort of repeating a sort of particular note and droning over and over it. So there's a sort of mantric feel. And so in the middle of that, you've got the guitarist, Michal Karoly, who was relatively conventional sort of guitarist, but you get the feeling that everybody in the group is kind of making space for everybody else. Mm-hmm. They're all, somehow... there's an immense amount of space in the music. And in the midst of that, you've got two vocalists, Malcolm Mooney and then Donald Suzuki, they're not like traditional frontman vocalists. Malcolm Mooney, I think it's almost like, he had a nervous breakdown. It's as if, and sometimes when he's singing, it's as if the music is driving him to distraction because he's sort of caught in this sort of free-flowing maelstrom of sound. And then Donald Suzuki, this Japanese guy, he had this kind of very delicate voice, and it's as if it's been kind of buffeted here and there, floating, on this kind of ether that's been created. And then at other times, he's kind of shrieking hysterically or whatever, So you know, there's a wonderful structure, you know, this wonderful way that they configure themselves to just release these kind of new energies from what was actually a conventional, relatively conventional lineup instrument-wise.
I'm James Ward, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's go on to Faust, who are a sort of another collective, and the stories of all these weird arty happenings and naked people on stage.
So
again, a completely different type of thing.
Well, Faust are a strange group because they were assembled by Uwe Nettelberg, who was kind of commissioned by, I think, a major German record label to create what they were, a new German Beatles. It would be simple enough. You know how the Beatles were in the 60s? Well, let's have a Beatles of our own, a German Beatles. And I think, you know, this is an idea he kind of sold to them, an idea that, you know, that they mutually sort of hatched together. And so he took a bunch of musicians from two middling prog bands at the time in West Germany, put them together with this producer, and sent, packed them off to this place, Wurmer, I think it was a disused school or something like that, you know, this complex in which, you know, they all had separate rooms and they could all play and jam and just see what they come up with, you know. So this absolute freedom, really, to sort of build something anew, you know, to sort of, you know, build this great new thing. But what they actually produced was clearly had no commercial prospects whatsoever. I mean, it's a sort of neo-Dadaist kind of collage of sort of barrages of electronics, sudden sort of moments of whistle-bucolic folk, mock brass bands, sort of, you know, symphonies, whatever. It's actually, I mean, the first album is actually a very, very beautiful thing, but it does remind you of that kind of, is it the exquisite chords game, you know, where you know, you just take sort of disparate, or like a Tristan Tzara thing, where, you know, you tear up sort of, you know, like a sheet of wood or whatever, and then put them in a hat and throw them in the air and see where they lie, and there's your poem. And they're almost like a kind of sonic realisation of that idea of Faust. Possibly my own, I mean, although Can are probably the greatest, Faust are probably my own favourite band of that particular genre. And they're the ones that tend to get overlooked. But at the time, they actually had, you know, they had quite a high profile because, you know, they had a lot of money behind them in Germany, you know, since it was especially with the German Beatles, though. I think the record company heard, when they got the first album through, they were utterly aghast. They allowed them to make one more album and said, can you at least make the tracks a bit short, you know, not have like one side dedicated to a kind of free-form jam. And then, of course, then they were dropped, you know, in Germany, and then they were left destitute. I mean, this place that they've been working in, they sort of turned overnight, you know, everything had gone, the fiction and physics and everything. They had to live on dog food for a while. They were just utterly left high and fire. But then Virgin in the UK found out about them. So in 1973, they came over to the UK, and, yeah, they did play various gigs that sort of, it was quite legendary from people there, because there were just, yeah, there were all kinds of things going on stage with people. They'd have pinball things set up, they'd have pinball machines, cement mixers, a sofa on stage. They kind of play when they felt like it. You know, they didn't obey, you know, completely fine disregard for any of the kind of rules, conventions of what a rock gig is supposed to be. But unfortunately, they didn't really get along with Richard Branson or the whole Virgin setup, and then had a Manor studio. And again, it's a problem. If they're not actually allowed to kind of record under their own conditions, then it just didn't really work for them. Although they made Faust 4 is a lovely album. And then they just gradually sort of went and drifted apart, and then went their separate ways. And yet, amazingly, 20 years later, they all kind of reunited again, and just pretty much in the mid-90s, by which point, you know, they gained a sort of retrospective kind of kudos. And there they were again, you know, down in, you know, in Islington, and sort of playing gigs, you know, the old cement mixers are out again, seeing the power tools, all that kind of stuff. The stuff they've been doing back in the early 70s.
Let's move on to Kraftwerk, who are, you know, by far the biggest name, the one band that most people will have heard, most people listening will have heard of. And I think also, weirdly, most people would, not being familiar with the concept of krautrock, would probably think of the sort of visual style of Kraftwerk as being that sort of, you know, Teutonic looking like robots type thing. At the same time, the Kraftwerk that we know is probably the furthest from the musical style that you describe here, but that wasn't the case to begin with.
So no, it wasn't at all. So they started off actually as part of this collective. You know, the first album in 1970 is called The Organisation, and on the instrument organ, you know, that Rutherford had played. And yeah, to be honest, I mean, you look at it, they're almost like a practically on the nose parody of krautrock. I mean, you know, there's bongos, there's flute solos. You know, there's long hair in abundance, there's, you know, there's colour, there's all the kind of sort of things you would associate, you know, with some sort of stereotype of krautrock. But gradually they kind of move away from that. I mean, one of the key things, you know that they move, you know, that Klaus Stinger, who was eventually drummer with Neu, was originally playing with them. But then they decided that drum machines were a little bit more interesting. And on the various albums, I think they love this kind of wonderful, you know, this rolling pulse that you get, you know, with, you know, and in fact, one time Ralph was talked about being at a party, and he just sort of set it going, you know, this drum machine, and it was about 1971, you know, it's a party, and then just leaves it on, and then goes out into the sort of crowd, and they just dance that, you know, for ages and ages, which was a similar epiphany that you got with people like DJ Kool Herc in America, you know, prior to sort of things like hip hop, that you could be just sort of go from the sort of, you know, the breakbeats of one 12-inch to another, whatever, you can create this kind of infinite groove, you know, that people can just dance to all night. Well, yeah, the Kraftwerk were doing that back in 1971. So that was one aspect of the music. So now it's got this kind of electronic underpinning. And then I think they developed a sort of art sensibility. They clearly were influenced by Gilbert and George, because the album Ralph and Florian, you know, they're sort of posing in a similar sort of way, and Florian Schneider is suddenly looking very dapper and sort of mock urbane. Ralph Hutter is still a bit lank-looking, whatever, but he's not quite made as good an effort. But it's almost like, you know, that we are the artwork, we are ourselves, you know, we are the work, you know, our kind of presence, you know, within this music is somehow the subject. And paradoxically, as with Gilbert and George, that's a good way of actually preserving your privacy by sort of presenting yourself as the artwork somehow or other. I mean, it's like, what do people really know about Gilbert and George in private life? They give away everything, paradoxically give away nothing, you know, and that's always been the case with Kraftwerk. We've always been, Ralph Hutter is exceptionally private, even though there they emphatically are, you know, their whole sort of bodies, you know, they're on the stage with their robot doppelgangers or what have you. So with Ralph and Florian, you know, they suddenly take on that kind of slightly more art sensibility. And then what's sad about Kraftwerk, in a or slightly wistful way, I always get wistful about Kraftwerk, is that you look at early sort of YouTube stuff of them, and you'd think they were essentially a kind of the Florian Schneider trio, some sort of neo-jazz combo that was essentially a showcase with the tall bloke and these kind of like extended flute solos. But then gradually, his flute then disappears from crap, you know, the less sort of crap rock it becomes. So by the time of Autobahn, it makes its very last appearance. You know, what seemed to be the kind of the key instrument, you know, the centrepiece of the music, then disappears altogether and they become this pure sort of electronic quartet. You know, must have been quite a sort of, they must have actually sort of had a discussion about it and said, look, for the sake of the music, you know, for the sort of great good, you're going to have to sacrifice the flute, yeah. So it makes its last appearance on Autobahn. It conveys the sense of, like, rolling verdant hills as they're kind of bowling along the kind of the grey ribbon of the sort of dual carriageway. And yeah, it's, so at that point, you know, they obviously become, at that point, you know, the antithesis of what people's stereotypical notions of krautrock. But they've actually built on that. I mean, they've evolved, and in fact, their foundations are very kind of krautrock. And there is this, at the same time, there is this kind of imperative to kind of, you know, especially the imperative of innovation, of electronics, of it not really being about, there's no choruses or whatever, and the vocals are deliberately, inverted commas, weak and rather fey or whatever. So there's all these kind of things, even crap at their kind of peak, you know, that 1974 to 1986 phase. Mm-hmm. Even then, they've still got things in common with groups like Can. You know, they don't sound the same, but there are certain, that they share common principles.
But why did Kraftwerk break out when none of the other bands really did in the same way?
Yeah, and I think it was because, I mean, they understood that the future was electronic. I mean, they understood in the way that David Bowie did. I mean, rock music just seemed to be, I mean, I think this is why David Bowie, I think, and he was obviously a very important figure in all of this. David Bowie, I think, he's languishing in LA in 1975. He's just drugged up to the gills. He's in an appalling state. His life is an absolute shambles. But he's surrounded by people in a similar state. I mean, you know, like people like The Who and like John Lennon and Harry Nilsson, all these people kind of living it up. And I think he understood, you know, that all these people that really dominated the late 60s, they've they've lost their edge, they're kind of bloated, they're driving Rolls Royces into swimming pools. But that is a kind of narrative that's run its course, and that kind of, you know, the whole West Coast Rock thing, you can see that its days are numbered, and these great figures, they're just sort of boozy legends now, but their days are numbered. And at some level, something stirs in him. He thinks, I've got to have a dialectical shift here. There's got to be a dialectical shift. We've got to go from west to east. And he does it in all kinds of banal, slightly crass ways. I mean, at one level, I think he goes to Berlin because he imagines it's going to be like Christopher Isherwood land or whatever. He's also got a very morbid and dubious, you know, preoccupation with Hitler that manifests himself in later in very dubious statements about how a dose of fascism would be great for Britain, and then the infamous supposed Nazi salute at Victoria Station. You know, all of that is all extremely dubious. But on the other hand, I think he understands. He goes there and he's introduced probably, you know, people like Brian Eno, who he's working with at the time, introduced him to the music of Leipzig, not just Kraftwerk, but also groups like Neu and Cluster and people like that. And, you know, I think he understands that this is where the future lies, that the preoccupation that these groups have had with invention is going to set them in, it may not have set them in sort of good stead, you know, for the sort of 70s, their own time, but they're laying the foundations, they're creating the templates for future music. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. Kraftwerk perfectly understood that. I mean, people obviously mocked Kraftwerk. They played up to that. They were just, this, you know, they dressed in these kind of conservative suits. They had short hair. They sort of have this kind of benign embrace of like machinery, and, you know, whereas a true passionate rock star would, you know, would scorn the inauthenticity and the fakeness of synthesizers as opposed to the realness of electric guitars, and they kind of like serenely overrode that. And yeah, and people laughed at Kraftwerk, but Kraftwerk definitely had the last laugh, because they understood that that was the future, and it was.
I'm Alex Cox, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So let's talk about that future then, the legacy of krautrock. If none of these bands, apart from Kraftwerk, became, you know, like massive, world-spanning sort of rock stars, certainly the sound of their music is sort of omnipresent across music nowadays. So let's start where that starts with. How does their influence start to...
Well, I think there's a general thing. So the first great wave of, like, krautrock-inspired groups were the post-punk groups. Now, a lot of those people, they would have been around, listening to music, in the early 70s, they would have seen Kangaroo, they would have seen Fats, they would have been aware of Kraftwerk. So we're talking about everybody from sort of Cabaret Voltaire to Pete Shelley of the Buzzcocks, even to Marquis Smith, Out of All, John Lydon. There's a whole host, Jim Kerr out of Simple Minds, Ian McCulloch, Bill Drummond, even, you know, later on that. And I think they all, the Krautrock groups appeal to them because they're just fed up of prog rock. They're fed up of, like, you know, these sort of self-important triple albums and the emphasis on virtuosity as the thing. And this mistaken idea that, like, groups like Yes, Genesis and that ELP had, that it was that rock needed to kind of graduate, you know, from its sort of adolescent 60s phase, and that in order to graduate and become a more mature form, it should be a bit more like classical music. It was a kind of banal and stunning misunderstanding, and something that Erwin Schmidt, as somebody who actually was brilliantly classically trained, you know, he saw through that. You know, he saw through that at the outset. He realised that that was a complete nonsense. So I think that they, if they were disaffected in those kind of, you know, in their late teens, you know, by prog rock, then groups like Can and Faust and Clamp, they were a godsend or whatever, because they were approaching music from the point of view of concepts and ideas. it was the ideas and not technical proficiency that counted. And I think that is, so therefore, you know, they related to those groups, and then, so when they kind of came into their own in sort of the late 70s, also, I mean, like, first of all, David Bowie had given the whole thing his blessing, and that and sort of just generally turned minds around on the whole idea of, like, German music and, you know, this is a new Teutonic cool that critics like John Savage kind of identified in sounds. And there was a general sense of, like, Europe being where it was at, you know. And, you know, obviously, it was, so Europe generally was where it was at. There was a general rejection of the Americanization of music that came with punk, you know. I mean, whether it was just singing deliberately cockneyfied or provincial accents or whatever. But Europe became, you know, they were looking east, they were looking to Europe and not to America in a way that music hasn't really died to that extent since, really. I mean, you know, there was, if you were a student, you were interrailing all over the place. So it was a kind of Europhilia in anything from Simple Minds, like Travel or whatever, you know, going to groups like Bauhaus, Wire, all of those groups. That was the first great sort of wave of, like, you know, that was the first great wave of Krautrock's legacy.
There's quite often a crass Germanophilia in some of those bands, though, is it? Like,
yeah,
Spandau Ballet,
well, of course,
Joy Division.
Well, definitely. I mean, absolutely, yeah.
Well.
I mean, you know, it was pretty crass, definitely. And this is the thing, you know, people... This is the trouble. I think there was, people never, especially at that time, people didn't entirely eliminate a sort of slightly dubious sort of Teutonic preoccupation that had some sort of slightly dubious elements. Yeah, and there's no doubt about it. I mean, Joy Division is a particularly good example. I mean, luckily their music is so great. They're such a brilliant band that in their case, you somehow end up sort of overlooking it. But no, Joy Division is a horrendous title for a group. If they'd have been rubbish, I mean, that's all you remember about them. Because they're brilliant, it's actually, that name was a bit dubious, wasn't it? Yeah, Spandau Ballet was, well, yes, it's a strange, that's almost like the kind of, almost the sort of austere, flouncing sort of amorality of the New Romantic movement. Bauhaus, I mean, I think they just picked it off the shelf, because they don't really, you know, the group Bauhaus don't embrace Bauhaus principles. Krautrock should have been called Bauhaus. If anyone's called Bauhaus, is it? That would have been too naff. Krautrock actually are the Bauhaus principles realised in popular music. But yeah, definitely, there was definitely a sort of Europhilia, and of course, because there was obviously the Krautrock, which was social, was predominant in that, you know, that was the first great wave of the late 70s, early
80s. And then hip hop.
Well, hip hop is a kind of curious one. I mean, it's more like, it was sort of tangential. What it was kind of like electro-funk. So with Krautrock, I mean, they'd been in places like Detroit in America, even they'd released a shortened version of Autobahn back in, you know, in 75 in America that had, like, really, really done well over there. And I think that whereas a lot of sort of white Anglo-American rock fans would have a problem with, like, synthesizers and electronic music. You know, they had always, you know, has all association with, like, plasticity, inauthenticity, not real music. Rock music's real music. I think that in black music, there's always been, and it's always been the case, there's always been a more futuristic strain. I mean, as I said earlier on, rock music does tend to be very, very conservative and retrospective. But, you know, if you're black, if you're African-American, you want to look to the future. You don't want to dwell on the past. Oh, weren't the 50s great? Weren't the 60s great? Not if you were black, they weren't. And I think this concept, there's always been, you know, from groups like, you know, sort of Sun Ra or whatever, you know, to sort of drum and bass, you know, wherever you look, you know, to sort of techno and things like that. There's always been much more of a sense of, like, you know, space is the place, the future is the place, you know, because things are going to be better out there. You know, the things represent a better world, a better life. Which, again, you know, I think is the reason why, you know, underground black music always tends to be at the kind of cutting, innovative edge. And I think that's the reason why there was a relationship, a strong relationship by people like Derek May, Afrika Bambaataa, back in 82, to Kraftwerk or whatever. They related to it completely. Also, they found it funky. Derek May had this phrase, Kraftwerk was so stiff, they're funky. You know, James Brown understood that. I mean, there's a very machinic element to sort of James Brown in the 60s and 70s or whatever. You know, people think that somehow, you know, to be machinic is to be un-black in some way, but not at all. If you listen to James Brown in the late 60s, it's very, very, very tight indeed. Tight, repetitious, locked room, and it almost sounds like, you know, it is, you know, Sex Machine, and it actually sounds like it is being produced by some sort of pneumatic instrument. So yes, there was an obvious, you know, it seems a very unlikely thing, the idea of, like, you know, these cerebral types from Dusseldorf having this huge influence on black African American music, but it does actually make sense the more you think about it. So, I mean, hip hop is kind of tangential. So there was this record, Planet Rock, Afrika Bambaataa made, that uses elements from the Trans-Europe Express from 1977. And then there's a sort of tangential relationship when hip hop really sort of gets into its own, you know, in sort of 83 with people like Run DMC, who aren't really directly influenced by Kraftwerk, but But certainly, I think that, you know, the idea of, like, you take a sort of, you know, a sampled sort of backbeat, or you create a backbeat, and then you have a rapper on top. Well, I mean, you know, there's a sort of clear antecedent there. Certainly, definitely on the whole sort of techno thing that emerged out of, like, and the whole Chicago scene, so the whole house techno thing that emerged in the 80s and mid-80s, and everybody from Jeff Mills to Derek May to Juan Atkins. Clearly, you know, they're clearly sort of, there's a clear tip of the hat, to say the least, to Kraftwerk, who have almost like laid down the kind of foundations. You know, you can really credit them being responsible for the electrification of modern music. I mean, because it's not just that, of course, there's electropop in the UK. Your Gary Newman's, your Orchestral Muse and the Dance, your Depeche Mode's, all of whom sort of stuck around, especially like a group like Depeche Mode. You think that the first fresh wind of fashion would just blow them away, but, you know, they had a long and enduring career.
And then, final question then, I mean, do you think, obviously, you know, you've written this book, which is, you know, a great big thick tones, all of these bands, but do you think now, finally, after all of that influence, that they are starting to get the recognition they deserve?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, and I think in a way, just the event of a book like this, you know, inevitably just helps with that. I actually, you know, proposed about 10 years ago, and at that point it got knocked back. I'm not quite sure. I mean, I could have written probably pretty much the same book then, you know, as it did now in lots of ways, except that, I mean, I would hope it inevitably becomes dated, because each subsequent generation in the 90s and the noughties, in each different way, a new generation of musicians come along, embrace the music and sort of taking it on board in different kinds of ways. In the 90s, there was this whole Stereolab, Kosmischer kind of type scene, which tends to relate to a specific strain of the music. You know, it's Future Days, obviously, with the title of the Can album. It's, you know, that's really what it's all about, that there's musicians yet unborn who will revisit this music that's so creative, so fertile, so sort of rich in potential and suggestions for new ways of doing things in, you know, in the perpetually conservative climate of, like, the music industry, even more conservative than ever. The, you know, I think the music will, you know, will continue, you know, these records will continue 40, 50, 60 years after they're made to be kind of touchstones.
I've been talking to David Stubbs. We've been talking about his book Future Days, Krautrock and the Building of Modern Germany, which is out now from Faber and Faber. David, thank you so much for coming in and talk to me about it.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, some great journalism and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.